Hello and welcome to Think Rant. I'm John Stabler.
I'm Steve Brett.
And this week is the debate you've all been looking forward to. With us is our friend Hazel James. Say hello.
Hello there.
And we're just going to cut straight to the chase. No messing around. I'll hand over straight to Hazel.
Noswaith dda a chroeso. Good evening and welcome to the first of, hopefully many, Think Rant debates. I'm Hazel James, and tonight I'll be chairing a debate over one of the hot topics of the moment, the proposition that religion is a force for good in the world. Debating this evening are the two hosts of the Think Rant podcast, Stephen Brett and John Stabler. For the motion is Stephen Brett. Stephen graduated in church history and theology from the University of Wales in Lampeter, and as a lifelong committed Christian, strongly believes in socialism, social justice, and equality. Against the motion is John Stabler. John is a software developer and is passionate about science, philosophy, and skepticism. The format for this evening's debate is straightforward. Both speakers will have 7 minutes to advance their arguments before spending a further 7 minutes each rebutting their opponent's points. They will then spend some time asking specific questions of each other before we arrive at the final questions and answer section where I put questions to the speakers. And without delay, I'd like to introduce the speaker for the motion, Religion is a Force for Good, Stephen Brett.
Thank you, Hazel. Now, this evening I've been tasked with arguing that religion is a force for good in the world. I have to say that researching this has not been an onerous task, far from it, although I found it very challenging. It's given me the opportunity to delve deeper into world religions rather than just my own Christianity. It's enabled me to see some of the great work that religious organisations around the world take part in. However, as Christianity is an area with which I am most familiar, I will mainly reference that. Now, sure, there are many difficult questions to answer, and I have no doubt that John will address these in his argument. But far too often I have heard the saying, religion causes all the wars in the world, and that religious people are paedophiles and bigots. And you know what? Religion has been responsible for some pretty major problems in the world, and I for one would want to distance myself from fundamentalists, whether they be Christian, Muslim, or followers of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. It's not my intention tonight to try and justify or defend the atrocities that have been committed in the name of religion. Any attempt to do so would be disingenuous and indeed offensive. One cannot defend the indefensible. What I hope to show here is that for all its well-publicised faults, religion can be, and still is, a force for good in the world. Religious organisations and charities raise millions of pounds for good causes every year. This money has been vital for projects around the world. For example, last year, Christian Aid spent over 75 million on charitable activities. This year, it's pledged 1.3 million to the flood relief projects in the predominantly Muslim country of Pakistan, following what the UN has called the worst natural disaster since the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. They've not limited their aid to solely Christian peoples or organisations, but to all affected, by providing food, emergency shelters and basic medical provisions. Neither is this being used to evangelise. Christian Aid's priority is simple. It's there to enable people to make a living and to empower local communities to do so in a sustainable way. In their words, time may not heal wounds, but if the relief efforts are timely, the difference will be felt both now and in the long term. The money raised by Christian Aid is predominantly raised through Christian religious groups. And Christian Aid is one of the hundreds of religious organisations that contribute to a better world annually. The question I would ask at this point is, how is this not good? Another charge often levied at religion would be that it propagated the slave trade. Now true, the established church in England did indeed support the slave trade and also the superiority of the white man, a position which as an Anglican I feel is most reprehensible and one that I feel great shame for. Yet arguably the driving force behind the abolitionist movement was William Wilberforce. William Wilberforce was a committed Christian who, as well as fighting for abolition, also established the Church Missionary Society. What was his motivation for his work? His faith. One of the other leading forces in the abolitionist movement was the Society of Friends, also known as the Quakers. The work of Wilberforce and the Quakers ended slavery in the British Empire and freed thousands of slaves. Again, I ask, how is this not good? and there are many more examples where religions have impacted the society around them and improved the lives for the better. What would we have, say, if these religions and the faithful who practice them were to be consigned to history? I don't know, but we can take a look at some of the atheist states in the world today. But at this juncture, I want to point out that I'm not for 1 minute suggesting that all atheists are either fascists or communists. Far from it. But the suggestion that religion is not a force for good suggests that it's either the opposite, i.e. bad, or somehow morally ambiguous or neutral. I would like to point out that the same may be said for atheists, humanists and secularists, indeed any human being. So let's take a look at China. Since its revolution in 1912, China has been a communist country. Its most famous infamous communist leader was Mao Zedong. One of Mao's most famous policies, the Great Leap Forward, led to the death of an estimated 45 million people over a 3-year period. 45 million. Compare this to the 22 million who died in service during World War II, or the 10 million or so that died in World War I. How many more people have died in China as victims of crime against humanity since the Great Leap Forward? How many have been tortured and killed for trying to obtain their civil liberties? Remember Tiananmen Square? How about Tibet? But it's not just China. What of the former USSR or North Korea? None of these are particularly renowned for their great works in human rights. Yet one of the great tenets of communism remains, and that is that atheism is fundamental to success. Now, religion is, for the most part, is a very personal experience. It's about building a relationship with your God. Religion has always filled a spiritual hole for people. In those moments of tribulation, we often cry out to God, or those joyous occasions where we can only thank our God for such joy. Einstein wrote, "The most beautiful emotion we can experience is the mystical. It is the sower of all true art and science. To know that what is impenetrable to us really exists, manifesting itself to us as the highest wisdom and the most radiant beauty, which our dull faculties can comprehend only in their most primitive forms. This knowledge, this feeling, is at the heart of all true religiousness." Even one of the great atheist thinkers of our generation, A.C. Grayling, accepts that religious faith on the individual level can be something that sustains and succours people. Some people simply have a spiritual need which needs to be met, and we'll always be searching. If religion, as atheists suggest, a delusion, then it doesn't detract from the fact that it fills the gap of the spiritual that exists in our consciousness. How else do you explain that religion has existed for as long as there have been humans walking on this earth? I hope that I have shown that religion is still a force for good in this world, providing humanity with both material and spiritual support when it is needed. That despite its many well-publicised flaws, it still offers hope to billions of people around the world. Finally, I would like to say that neither religious nor secular people have the monopoly on good deeds or morality. All humans have the capacity for good or for evil. It is the choices that we make which will define us. Religion, as we've heard, can motivate people to do bad things, and that is undeniable. However, it can also motivate people to great goodness. I want to leave you with the only two commandments that Christ gave us, from the Gospel of Matthew. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbour as yourself. Now, whether you are religious or not, humanity would not go far wrong if it followed only the second of those two commandments. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. And now against the motion, John Stabler.
Thank you, Hazel. Let me start out by saying that I don't envy anybody defending the position that religion is a force for good, especially considering the increased criticism seen over the last few decades. And so I would like to thank Stephen for accepting what has become an enormously difficult task. Unfortunately for him, not only will I be arguing that religion is not a force for good, but it is, in most cases, quite deserving of the criticism. Religious apologists such as Stephen are keen to persuade you that acts of moral good and kindness from religious people are examples of a higher morality and a testament to their religion. However, they can't cherry-pick. If something is moral simply because there are examples of good being performed, then surely nearly everything is moral. The leaders of totalitarian regimes have done plenty of things we would consider good and moral, but would we be so quick to say that, therefore, totalitarianism is moral? And the same is true of the opposite. A bad act does not a bad ideology make. In the interest of an intellectually stimulating debate, I will be refraining from resorting to identifying individual acts of evil as examples. I was going to say that is unless my opponent engages in such rhetoric, which he did. And unfortunately, I think it's not in his interest to do so. But I will refrain nonetheless. But let's just state a fact which I think we can both agree on. People do good things, and people do bad things, sometimes using religion or an ideology to justify it. Let us not, however, ignore the implications of Stephen's argument. If we follow logically from the premise that religion is inherently more moral, then will he really defend the position that religious people are, in general, more moral than irreligious? Will he ignore the underrepresentation of non-theists in prison populations around the world? Or the atheist philanthropists whose charity work and fight against poverty is done free of proselytizing? Will he boldly assert, therefore, that I am, by definition, less moral than he? In the only instance of borrowing I will consciously be doing, I would like to paraphrase a challenge made by the friendly polemicist Christopher Hitchens. Name one moral statement or action that could be made by a believer that could not be made by a non-believer. To date, I haven't heard a single reply that fulfills what is, in actuality, a very simple criteria, and that isn't contingent on some religious assumption. One such example was teaching a child to pray. The fact that a vast population of religious apologetics and apologists can't cobble together a half-cogent reply to this challenge is, I think, a damning indictment of the false assumptions made about the religious being more moral. And if they are not more moral, and they perform no net good, then where is my opponent's argument? I believe the game is up for the promoters of faith as a path to goodness. Only these past few weeks, the Dalai Lama himself announced that he was convinced that anyone can develop a good heart and sense of universal responsibility with or without religion. The Queen has come out, the head of the church in England, has come out saying that the faithful don't have a monopoly on virtue. Will we now see moral philosophers and applied ethicists taking the place of clerics in moral debate? I believe it's time that the dog collar should give way to the humanist philosophy on Sunday morning television as we struggle with what is undoubtedly a purely human condition. As I said, I wish to avoid the usual rhetoric, and so I'm keen to test out my main argument. My charge against religion has been stated in many different forms, but this evening I will be attacking the problem of religion at what I consider to be the source, faith. In every conversation with a theist, and every other engagement I have seen that has followed a logical path, the Socratic method excels. Faith is the resultant answer. After rebuttal, followed by rebuttal, there is a hasty and predictable retreat to faith, or worse, solipsism or ignorance. And whereas the pious have been keen to depict faith as a virtue, the rest of us have seen it for what it would be in any other situation, gullibility, credulity of the highest kind. And it is only after the tempering of secularism and the clipping of its wings that religion looks like the empty vessel that it is. It is devoid of any such epistemological underpinnings, and we are forced to ask the question, what can a vacuous, hand-waving philosophy tell us about truth? Whether something is moral? Whether something is good? What we should do with our lives, and what our lives mean, if anything? How can a person who decides what they believe on faith, where anything goes, whatever you want, or whatever makes you happy, look me in the eye and say they care about truth? And if they don't care, why would we care about what they have to say in the sphere of morality or politics or philosophy? Worldviews where the eternity thereafter is spent as the insignificant wretch you are glorifying the great one, or inflicting pain and suffering for 75 virgins, the followers of these ideals have the nerve to accuse materialistic philosophies of being nihilistic. Unfortunately, it is only faith and dogma that would have science ignored in favour of scripture-compatible indoctrination, that would have women believe that an all-powerful deity cares about how much of their skin can be seen in the sun, whether they can drive a car or be a bishop in the church. Only faith would have us believe that a potential life, in the form of a sperm, an egg, or an embryo, has more value than that of a woman or her reproductive rights. And let us not forget the ugly head of censorship that has emerged, not via good old-fashioned torture or fear of death, but by the crying of offence by the moderates and the threat of violence from the extremists. And when there is justified criticism by those that speak out over the misogyny, racism, brutality, and attacks on freedoms of speech in the name of respect, the repercussions are laid at the door of the critics in what I consider to be like blaming the rape victim for dressing provocatively. We are continually faced with attacks on our freedoms, bought with the lives of our forefathers, with violence, intolerance, and newly enacted blasphemy laws. In closing, I'd like to ask people to think for themselves about whether religion is a force for good. Is it religion doing the good, or is it the people? Can we not keep the good aspects, prevent the bad, and lose the superstitious, irrational baggage that is still responsible for the subjugation of women around the world and the AIDS epidemic in Africa? My opponent argues that we need to keep the superstitions and customs of ancient goat herders who knew nothing of science and civilized society in order to live good lives. I say, with science and knowledge as our guide, the unknown will be ever shrinking and the needs of humanity can come first. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Stephen, are you ready to speak about the motion again?
Well, I'm not sure if I've got anything to particularly speak about. It's just a few points, really, which I sort of picked up on from what John was saying there. And, you know, as I said in my speech, I agree with a lot of what you said, to be honest with you. I don't believe that, you know, religion is the, or rather goodness is the sole ownership then of religious people. Far from it. I think that, you know, there are plenty of people out there who are good, who have no religious faith. But religious faith is a choice. And, you know, in a liberal society, people should have the absolute freedom of belief. And I'll quote Evan Harris here from The Guardian this weekend. But a liberal secular democracy is the best protector of religious freedom because it says that we need to guarantee absolute freedom of belief. Now, what John is suggesting there is that I don't have a right to believe, that actually I should believe in science. And I do. I do believe in science. I think science, obviously, plays an absolute fundamental part in society today. But I disagree with his point about us, you know, being basically no better than goat herders herding sheep around the Middle East. Far from it. There are many Christian thinkers today who are, you know, leaders in their fields, and not just fields of theology, but fields of medicine and science as well. And these people have their faith. Are we saying they're no better than the unintelligent and uneducated goat herders? I'd like to think not, to be honest with you. Again, I absolutely, as I say, agree with what the Dalai Lama said. I don't believe that you have to be religious to be good. Absolutely not. Fundamentally believe that. You know, I would say if my colleague sat opposite me, he is a good person, but he has no faith. Now, I'm a good person, but I have a faith. That doesn't lessen or cheapen that fact that I am a good person purely because I have a faith. It's my right to have a faith. It's my right to have a belief. And as a liberal, we should be fighting for that to be enshrined, really, to be honest with you, that actually I do have a right to believe and to, you know, follow what I think is true for me. Because I do disagree with what you said about faith and truth, and basically saying that all theists are liars, is essentially what you said. Because for them, faith is truth. It is truth for them to believe, and they're entitled to have that belief. On the point of misogyny and women not being, or women being veiled and not driving cars, I'm surprised that John actually, you know, having said he wasn't going to stoop to the levels of rhetoric, actually did come up with that, to be honest with you. I was a bit disappointed, because you're quite right, that's indefensible. And as I said in my speech, I cannot defend the indefensible. That's wrong. It's not correct. Says about the misogyny within the Church of England and not allowing women bishops. I would argue that there is a, well, not even argue, there is a strong movement within the church of people who want to see that reversed, of people who do want to see women bishops, of people who don't have objections to homosexuals within the church, and we're fighting very strongly for the rights of those people. Because like John would fight for the rights of those people in the secular society, we too fight for those people within our religious society. And to suggest that we are all misogynist homophobes, I think is far from the truth. And that, yeah, I mean, that kind of pretty much is it. The only other thing which I wanted to pick him up on, actually, is because I'd like to know where he got his figures from, is about the number of theists in prison. Did you say, or can you just clarify for me, that there are more theists in prison than not?
Per population, so obviously the main study was conducted in America. And this should be left for questions, I hate to say.
Oh, okay. No, I wanted to clarify it just purely because I've read an article recently and I can't reference it, unfortunately. That's the problem, which said the complete opposite of that. And maybe that's a UK-based. So yeah, and you know, John, therefore, is absolutely right. Non-religious people are no less moral than religious people. But on the flip side of that, neither religious people any less moral than non-religious people. I think there's very much a status quo there. And, you know, as I said, humanity is capable of great good and great evil. And it's down to us how we live that out is what we should be judged by. And that's what I would say on that, to be honest with you.
Are you coming back with anything, John?
Thank you. I think I will be taking up my 7 minutes again here. I'm sorry about that. One thing I would like to say is I'm very sorry if it came across that I somehow think that people shouldn't be able to believe whatever they want to believe. I don't think for one second. I think in a secular society, and this is why I support a secular society rather than a theocracy, is that everybody can have whatever belief they want, whether it is a religious belief or lack of. So I don't want to come across as somebody who's into some kind of thought crime where we force theists to stop believing in God, which, to start with, I think is impossible anyway. I just wanted to pick up on some quick points, and then I think I'll rebut your rebuttals, if that's okay. The religious charities raising money, I have no doubt about it whatsoever. However, and as the main point of my argument was, you know, does this make religion good? I don't think it does. I just think it's people doing good things. And so I would just say, well, secular charities raise money as well. I would not want to take away from any religious charity, especially if they do good work without proselytizing. So I can't disagree with that. William Wilberforce and his, you know, fight against the slave trade. The only problem I had with this point, of course, is that it is very easy to look at the Bible and see justification for slavery. I think you'd be mad to say that that wasn't in there. However, I don't think you have the same grounds to say that there's no scriptural basis for the abolition of the slave trade, as far as I'm aware. But I'm sure Steve is going to correct me in question time. But what my point is, it's very obvious in the Old Testament that not only was slave trade permissible, but it spent a great deal of time telling people how they should keep their slaves, how often they can beat them. I won't go on simply for rhetorical reasons. I've got to pick up on the China and the communism, and how can you basically try and associate atheism with communism. The reason I don't agree with that, okay, is because simple definitions, okay. I challenge Stephen, if he is to lay the blame for communism, to put it in bed with atheism and to say that they are causal, he must produce a logical syllogism. Well, to say that it has anything to do with atheism, he would have to form a logical syllogism which goes from I do not accept that there is a God to therefore I need to murder people. So I just lay that challenge out there. If it wasn't intended, then fine. I've just quickly as well, just because religion has been around through human history, is it good? I mean, this debate is about whether it is a force for good. Does that make it good? I mean, simple. Daniel Dennett said this morning when I was listening to him. He said the cold virus has been around through the whole of human history. I don't think that's good. I don't think that's moral. I don't think, you know, I just can't see how. In other words, that is a non sequitur. So we'll move on. Also, I was going to leave this out, but Stephen mentioned this, that you know, religion itself can be the motivator for good. And I think this is a very interesting point, because ultimately I think it cheapens any morality that comes out of religion. If you perform an act, okay, not because it is good within itself, but because you believe that you will be rewarded, or you, if you don't do it, you will somehow be punished. That, to me, is not morality. That is the very opposite of morality. That is just you doing something to further your own agenda, so you can have paradise, or you can avoid hellfire. So if anybody says that they did it for another reason, other than the fact that it is good in of itself, I think that is... Again, I can't believe that people would claim that as a good thing of religion. I'd like to apologise if I came across as implying that people that believed in religion were as dumb as goat herders. Now, I'm sorry if it came that way. What I said in my speech was that the superstition of goat herders, the superstition and, what I'm saying is these people were simple. There's no denying it. They didn't understand the world like we know it now. They didn't have the scientific method. I don't want to say that they were completely retarded in any way. However, for them, not understanding things, and this is probably the same reason why a lot of people believe now, is they don't have the answers to questions. So therefore, they feel they are justified in making up an answer. To me, that is not honest. You know, so goat herders knew less. They attributed more things to God. This sounds like God of the Gaps to me. A lot of intelligent people do believe in God. I don't deny this. I don't think it makes them stupid. I do, however, think that the cause for them believing it is not because they're stupid, but because of simple indoctrination in the first place. I don't think all theists are liars, okay? But what... my opponent Stephen put forward that it is truth for them. Unfortunately, again, he has just come up against a big philosophical barrier. We don't define truth as something that everybody, you know, whatever you want, that's true. That is not how we define truth, okay? Truth is something that is objective. It is something that we all can agree on, or at least agree on in a practical way, okay? And for this, I suggest empirical to start with, okay? If we say that whatever's true for you, then why have this debate in the first place? Because otherwise we're just going to talk past each other, because we both believe that we are both completely delusional. I think if we are to have any kind of discussion, we must have an expectation that one of us may be wrong and they're willing to be corrected. I think if we both believe that whatever we want, then everything's futile, and guess what? That's solipsism. So let's avoid that, please. I think I've taken my 7 minutes.
Okay. Are you coming back again, Stephen?
Okay, I've got one question for you on the subject of indoctrination.
Of course.
I totally find that farcical that you would suggest that. From the point of view, take someone such as Alistair McGrath, who I know you're not a fan of per se, but this man was an atheist and converted to Christianity.
Yeah.
Where was the indoctrination there to convert him into a Christian from an atheist? And the other question which I'd like to ask you, you yourself mm-hmm. used to be a Christian. Now you're an atheist. Where was your indoctrination?
Right. Well, of course there was indoctrination. I will explain. Why are Christians Christians? Why are Muslims Muslims? Okay. I know there are exceptions to the rules, but my point is this: 99.9% of people who are of faith are of that faith not because they chanced upon the scripture and read it and decided this was the truth. Okay? These people believe this because they were told to believe it. Their parents believed it. Their families believed it. Their neighbours believed it. And so if from a young age you are taught, and this is the problems with indoctrination, if you are taught on a weekly basis that something is true, why am I not surprised that later in life, that when questioned on this, you will use it as a basis of an assumption, and everything will be in terms of that assumption. And so I think it, for me, it's pretty obvious why people are a Christian, why people are Muslim, because they grew up as a Christian or a Muslim.
I wouldn't necessarily not concede that point, but my question still remains.
Want to know about Alistair McGrath.
How does that explain someone like Alistair McGrath, who was an atheist and has become a Christian, and is a very intelligent man?
Well, I don't know if I agree
because
on all of those
I don't think the argument of indoctrination stands up in the case of someone like McGrath.
But are you so you're saying that my entire point about people being indoctrinated is completely invalid
example? Far from it.
Well, then, so I just stand by my original point.
I'm giving you one example of, there are plenty more out there. Mm. What I'm saying is, I think your point of everyone is indoctrinated is fallacy.
I don't want to have to rewind it.
There may be people who are indoctrinated, but I think there's plenty of people out there who are able to think their own mind and make that decision themselves. And I think for you to suggest otherwise is disingenuous.
Okay, well, I'm sure when we listen back to this, you will notice there was no every person being indoctrinated in what I said. So I'm afraid that was a bit of a reflex reaction from you there, Stephen.
I disagree. Going back to the point of the biblical justification for slavery, sure, there is slaves in the Bible. Can't deny it, won't deny it. The Old Testament is very much the Old Testament and was superseded by the New Testament and by Christ. Now, the point is, as I summed up at the end of my speech, is that the second commandment that Jesus gave us is to love your neighbour. That, for me, suggests that actually, no, slavery is not acceptable, because how is that loving your neighbour that you're enforcing somebody to do work for you? So I would disagree with that point. I would say yes, in the Old Testament.
Sorry, do I get to answer the question?
Yes, by all means. Sure. I should just finish off my point, which was that yes, I would agree in the Bible there are, and even in the New Testament from Paul, there are suggestions that slaves should obey their master. So I agree with you that the Bible is misleading on that point. But hey, the Bible was written by men. I'm sorry if that offends other religious and Christians out there, but the Bible was written by men, and you know, they quite often had an agenda themselves when they wrote it.
Okay. Well, in answer to your question I think for you to interpret love your neighbour in such a casual way, although, you know, by all means, as a Christian, you're entitled to interpret your own theology. However, I think, let us not forget that when Christ turned up, he said that he did not come to change the law, he came to fulfill it. And this is quite clear. And so I disagree fundamentally with what you said about the Old Testament.
He fulfilled the law and superseded it by his commandments.
But he didn't, because if he can't come and change the law, because he said himself, I did not come to change it, I came here to fulfill it. He did not say, I came here to supersede it.
When he was asked specifically the question, which is the greatest commandment, he responded with, honour God and love your neighbour. That was his response to that.
But
the
also
rest of it doesn't come into it, as far as I'm concerned.
I would just like to say, and I'm not going to argue over it, because obviously it's going to be an interpretation thing, I just think that your definition of neighbour may not fit in with some of the older interpretations, because your neighbour was literally the person of your caste. So slaves would not have been included in that. But as I said, that's an interpretation. And I just think, of course, your interpretation is good for you.
And that's fair enough. I respect that. I want to clarify my point, if I may. You can ask me the question if you want, around atheism and communism. Yeah? I'm not trying to say that atheism and communism, or that rather as a result of atheism, it leads to communism, leads to murder. That's not what I'm trying to say at all. My point is that I'm literally trying to make is, you will sit there and you've made the point that religious people, not all of them, but you've made the point, misogyny, oppression of women, etc., etc. My point is, the same sort of things can be said about atheists. Just as the moral good is not the sole preserve of the religious, neither is the opposite.
Yeah, and when I saw your face,
which is my point.
Sorry, when you picked up on that, and I just want to clarify what I was saying. I said I didn't want to identify acts of evil, and that's why you heard no talk of the Crusades, you heard no talk of Inquisitions and things like that. Okay. However, what my argument against things like misogyny, OK, Okay, it was a philosophical argument. It wasn't trying to talk about history, and I'm not trying to create a body count here. I was talking about the
Fortunately, because.
yeah. I was just simply talking about what dogma leads to. Okay, and we can't deny that religion is dogma because that is it by definition. And so that is my point. And it wasn't, and it was an argument against religion in general. It's so it wasn't point scoring. It wasn't trying to, say, this is all religion's fault. I'm saying in general, when we use faith rather than reason, that is.
And that's the same type of point I'm trying to make about communism and atheism, is that actually, it's.
So are you going to give me that logical syllogism that I asked for?
Well, no,
Because.
my point quite simply is this, is that you will say that, Christians are guilty of misogyny, etc., etc., etc. Whether you trying to put it as a philosophical point or not, that is exactly what you're saying.
No, sorry, no,
And
what I'm
my point in
saying is
response is that
religions.
actually, no, that's not just the preserve of the religious or the non-religious.
No, sorry, what I'm saying is faith and dogma, okay, and I will repeat it, a casual attitude to truth, and I'm sure you'll want to pick me up on this, is, by its very nature, going to lead to those things. And I'm not saying that religious people do this. Okay, I think you're missing the point. I'm not saying that religious people are misogynist, religious people are racist. I already said in my speech that there are good people that do good things, there are bad people that do bad things, and some are done in the name of religions or ideologies. But what I'm my point was far more precise in that the dogma and faith of religion leads to this unchangeable situation where there is persecution, where there is misogyny, and where there is racism.
I would dispute that it's an unchangeable situation because, as I said, we already have women priests within the Church of England, and we're fighting for women bishops as well.
Okay,
So
I
I would
will
contest that
change
point.
my word, and I will say not unchangeable, but painfully hard to change. Okay, can I?
Well,
Will you
that is the truth, and I'll accept
right?
that for sure.
Okay, thank you.
And just my final point, if I may make it. I'm sorry, I've kind of maybe gone off track with the question here, so I do apologise. Which is, again, you seem to suggest that religious people only do good acts because of fear of punishment. That's not the case.
I didn't say it was only,
No,
I
no,
was
no,
just
you
motivation.
did suggest that. You did suggest that. Now, motivation for doing it comes back to that point of love your neighbour for me, and I don't do whatever good acts that I do, whatever charity that I do, I don't do that for fear of punishment for not doing it. I do it because that phrase, which as you've said is open to interpretation, love your neighbour, inspires me to do that. Now that's not to say that a non-religious person can't have that inspiration, I wouldn't say that for a minute, but for me, that's what inspires me, is those words to go and do those acts of charity that I may do.
Okay, sorry, and I think it's going to be another case of listening back to it. I don't think that I said all religious people do that. I just picked up on the
You
fact when you.
suggested it.
No,
It
no.
wasn't that you said it explicitly, but you suggested
I
it.
just picked up on your use of the word motivated by their religion, and I just wanted to pick up on that. If you are motivated by your religion, then I think that is what I was talking about. I'm not talking about all religious people, whatever they do, is it all really? No, I didn't say that. So I just think, I accept your point and I agree with you, but I'm just saying that's not what I said. Well, as far as, I mean, I've made all my points as well
Yeah,
in
I'm done as well.
so I'm happy to take questions.
If religion is the force for good, then are there religions that are more of a force for good than others, and why?
No. I can't answer that question. I mean, I don't know enough every religion in the world. I don't know enough about it in general. I wouldn't like to say that there is one religion which is more good than the other. I
You're not
can't say
even going
that.
to side with the home team?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I refuse to. I don't think that there is any one religion which can stand up and say, "Hey, we're better than the rest of you." Don't think so for a minute.
Other religions might look at Christianity and say that, which is.
Well, they're entitled to personal opinions. My opinion is that I can't make that decision because I don't believe for one minute that Christianity. I respect the beliefs of those people who hold those religions. Might not necessarily agree with those beliefs, and in some cases, looking at Islam and the way they treat women, fundamentally disagree with it. They're still entitled to their belief, and I wouldn't say that my religion makes it any better than them, because as John's pointed out, there's plenty of flaws within my own which need addressing. So, no, I would say there is no one religion that is better than the other.
As far as my opinion, I agree with Steve. I mean, the only thing we obviously disagree on due to the debate is whether religion is a force for good. I don't think, a lot of people would say to me, well, John, don't you think Islam is worse? I think they're all equally dangerous in different ways. I mean, don't get me wrong, in the UK, Christianity has been tapered by secularism. You know, and as a lot of people have pointed out, it's become more of a sort of eccentric pastime more than anything. So I don't see that as a threat, apart from in terms of freedom of speech and things. So, no, I'll leave that there.
John, if you believe religion is not a force for good, do you also believe the world would be a better place without religion?
I think by definition and my argument, which was a purely philosophical argument on truth and how we arrive at it, I would have to say that I believe that the world would be better without it. And this comes back to the question which I did throw out there, and I would still be interested if Steve would answer it, from Christopher Hitchens, which is, name one moral statement or action that could be performed by a religious person that couldn't be done by a non-religious person. If the answer is, you know, if the answer is no, I can't, then, you know, that's fine. You know, I'm not going to take him to task on it. I don't want to put him on the spot. But, you know, if you've really got to think about it, I think that kind of backs up my point. And I think that all that's left then, if it is no more moral, all that's left is what I call the superstition. And I think that's one thing that we can do without.
Can I clarify my point then, John?
Sure,
finish
sure.
There? To answer your question from Christopher Hitchin, I think I was quite clear in my speech. No, I don't think there is anything that is peculiar to a religious person that a non-religious person can't do. I don't think there is. You know, I know you've dissed this in your speech, but it is, and it comes up to, it's a matter of faith, and you see that as a superstition, I see that as faith. And that's, I guess, is the major difference between us.
Yeah, I mean, well, we identified that ages ago.
Yeah.
Stephen, why is religion so divisive?
That is a very difficult question. I guess it's because it comes down to a matter of belief and belief system. And when people end up fundamentally disagreeing, that causes arguments. So, for example, as I said, I fundamentally disagree with the way that Muslims treat women. Muslims may disagree with me on that point. But then likewise, you can have politics, and I can fundamentally disagree with a conservative because I don't agree with their politics, and we'd have a similar sort of argument because of that, because I guess it's an ideology. So I guess that's why it is so divisive, is because actually people fundamentally believe these things, and I guess that's where the argument goes, really. I'm sorry I can't answer any better than that, but I guess that would be my answer.
The one thing I'd like to say about divisiveness is, I think that at a fundamental level, you know, just looking at it philosophically, we can say that there's a lot of people making claims of truth, and they all contradict each other. And so we've got to come to the, you know, and I just wanted to say we've got to come to the realization that they can't all be right.
Absolutely. You know, if I may, you know, saying religion is divisive, I'll give you an example of climate change. You know, you've got one group of scientists who are quite clearly saying climate change is happening and climate change is a very real risk to the world. And then you've got another group of scientists saying, actually, it's not as bad as you all think it is. So I think there are fundamental differences of opinion there as well. So I don't think divisiveness is necessarily the preserve of religion.
No, sure, and I'll agree with that. But the climate change example, however, it's kind of like, you know, you throw a ball into a box, and then it comes out the other end a different colour, and you're not quite sure why. And I think to say that climate change is somehow opaque, you know, the facts behind it are opaque, I think is wrong. I think when talking about reality, there is a case to be made. Okay, either there is anthropomorphic climate change, human-caused climate change, or there's not. And I think arriving at the truth is a matter of science and actually finding out the facts. But I think, unfortunately, in that case, there has been other things thrown into the mix, such as politics, such as ideologies. For example, politics, people who have investments in oil, people
Yeah, absolutely.
who this is going to affect financially, ideologically, and this is just a very special case, but I'd throw it out there. You've got the likes of fundamentalist Christians like Sarah Palin and some of them, whose argument against global warming is that God promised he would never destroy the earth again, and so they're willing to ignore all of the science simply because it conflicts with them. And I mean, that's not a, I'm not going to even lay that at religion's door, because I think I'm going to lay that at the stupid door more than anything. But as I said, I can see where you're coming from with the analogy. However, I don't think it is quite the same, in so much that there is a way to tell if global warming is caused by humans or not, whereas I think metaphysical claims of the religious are
No,
never going to be solved.
I see your point, man, but I guess even though you say there are ways to tell it, at the moment you've got one group claiming we're right. And you've got the other group claiming we're right,
Yeah, but I but
and
also
so
there's
that's my point there, is that you've got two groups claiming that they're right, and there is a clash in the middle of that.
sure, but yeah, but there's a disparity. Just I know you haven't said it, but just by inferring the way you're saying it, you're like saying it's like a 50-50 split. That is not the case.
No,
There
that's
is the
fair enough.
majority of scientists agree that it is human caused. And although, I'm skeptical over all things, and I'm still interested in looking at their models and how they're built and things, I've got to defer to the experts. And all of the scientists that are claiming that it's all bunkum, they
And
all
the
seem to have they all
petrochemical companies.
yeah they have vested interests, or they're fringe or something like that. So I'm just yeah okay but I take your point.
Next question. John, why would you ignore the clear evidence of Christian moral teaching in our society and laws?
Now, my simple answer is I actually think putting the word Christian in front of it was in the invention of the Christians. I think moral teaching has always been around, and just to pick up the one example, because some people are very keen to point out how Jesus came up with this wonderful idea of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It sounds like a great idea, but unfortunately, that idea predates Jesus by 1,000 years in Chinese philosophy. And actually, the original was even better. It was do unto others as they would have you do unto them, which is even more tolerant, I believe. I think it might lead to some very nasty things, though. But that's my point, is a lot of people think that our morality nowadays, what you think, what I think, what Steve thinks, has been shaped by the Ten Commandments or by something Christian. I actually think the other way around. I think religions have always been tempered by morality of people. And this goes deeper into the source of morality, which we'll leave for today. That is a debate within itself. But I don't think it's one I'd ever have with Steve, because I think fundamentally he agrees with me. So I just don't buy the premise that the morality has come from Christian doctrine or Christian anything. I think that they've borrowed it like everyone else.
Stephen, your last question. What is good about the doctrines of original sin and substitutional atonement, or the promise of virgins for martyrs?
On the subject of original sin and the promise of virgins for martyrs, nothing at all. There's nothing good about it. I don't agree with it. I don't believe in it. On the subject of substitutional atonement, that's very interesting, actually, that's come up. Because at lunchtime today, it kind of struck me, what's John going to come at me with this evening? And I kind of expected this, so I started to try and think about it. And it's very challenging. Very challenging indeed, actually. And it's something which I'm trying to struggle with at the moment, to actually work out how that fits in.
Because just before I let you can continue, I just
Yeah,
want to
sure.
point out this is something that very few Christians think about, its implications. Just like very few Christians actually think about anything like free will or any of the deeper
Yeah.
philosophical things.
So I haven't spent a great deal of time thinking on this. It's only sort of been today, really, that I've really sort of thought about it in any depth. And so it's quite interesting it's come up, actually. Obviously, substitutional atonement is Jesus dying for the sins of the world on the cross, is the point. And yes, that's what we're taught. That's what we believe. Some would say, how can a just God allow that to happen? But actually, they're going to sacrifice someone for them. And yeah, I can see that point, I can follow that logic. But the thing which came to me today, and do forgive me because it probably is, sounds quite a weak argument because I haven't had time to really pay a lot of attention to it, is that, and yeah, even as I'm saying it, to be honest with you, I guess the point that I would make is people say, how can Jesus, how can God allow his son to die on the cross for mankind? I guess that's the point which we're driving at.
Well, it's not actually, but...
Oh, okay. Okay, but that's the way I've interpreted that. And I would say then, from that point of view, and this is the doctrine of the Trinity, is that Jesus is God, and God is Jesus. So what he's doing, he's actually doing unto himself. And I think it's an example to the people that actually you don't have to be making sacrificial offerings anymore to God. You don't have to be slaughtering lambs. You don't have to be slaughtering doves. Because it's not necessary anymore, because the relationship for God and man is completed through Christ. And as I say, at the moment, it's something which I am sort of struggling with, because I haven't really thought about it before. As John said, I guess it's something which people don't think about an awful lot, so it's something which I'm coming to terms with. So do forgive my answer if it does sound a little bit wishy-washy. I haven't really had time to sort of flesh it out or do much reading around it, but that's my initial thought then on it.
I've heard this argument against Christian teaching before, and I think it's actually very powerful about some of the assumptions that Christians make about their belief. And I'm sorry, but I find it quite interesting that you completely against the concept of original sin, which is, let's face it, it's one of the fundamental parts of Christian doctrine. And I'm not just talking about, we're not all literalists and things like that. I do think that, it's alluded to in the Nicene Creed when they said Jesus died for us. I believe that Jesus died, he came and died for our sins. I can't, I'm just paraphrasing it. I do believe that. But it does infer that we had sins that needed to be redeemed.
Yeah, I would take that as being that, yes, we do have sins, because as I said, man is capable of good and bad. And I think, we do sin, sometimes every day, sometimes, in our lifetime, at some point we'll do something which maybe isn't right.
But
and
if
that's
it,
a sin.
Yeah, sorry, but the point is, if it is a fact that we sin, then why do we need redemption? In so much that, if you do believe that ultimately, let's just leave the evolution debate aside. If you do believe ultimately that we are God's creation, then he created us knowing that we would sin, surely.
But then
why would we need redemption?
No, but you see, this I think is coming down to the whole predestination free will thing, isn't it, I suppose? Is I believe that God gave us the free will to choose, and sometimes we make the wrong decisions.
But he still knew we would make wrong decisions.
Yeah. And that's partly a learning experience for us, isn't it? We learn from those experiences, and we grow and we develop as human beings through those experiences. When things don't go right, when we make wrong decisions, when we make bad decisions.
So, hang on, sorry, you do believe that we have free will?
Yeah.
But do you not believe that God also intervenes?
God can intervene, yes.
But does he?
Yes, I believe so.
So then how can we have free will?
Well, because actually I can make a choice to go out and shoot someone. Do you know what I mean? That's my choice.
But if God
that.
Stops it, then he's just interfered with your free will.
Yeah, he has.
So then how do you have free will if at any point God could stop you?
Don't know.
I wouldn't expect you to answer because it's been vexing theologians for years.
But I just think that, at the end of the day, let me then rethink this and rephrase this. Rather than free will, we have a certain amount of free will to make choices for ourselves, which could be good or could be bad.
Well, I just think if you only got half free will, it's not free will, is it? So, it's not free will unless it is completely free.
Yeah, okay. I'll concede that point.
But I didn't want to get drawn on that. I just think original sin is fundamentally immoral because we were created in this game, in effect.
I totally agree for that reason, that original sin is immoral, because I think it's absolutely offensive to say that a child born into this world
is already
guilty of some sort of sin which their forefathers have made for them. I think that's absolutely horrendous. And no, that's why I don't agree with original sin.
Okay, that's great. And I just thought substitutional atonement, coupled with original sin, because it was meant to be the answer.
I can see the point you're going with that.
It is immoral also. From where you were coming from, you know, the stopping of, you know, blood sacrifice. And if we look at it as the mythology, which, you know, I believe it is, I can see why that came around, because it was more of what we saw in the Old Testament of blood sacrifice. But this was meant to be the one to stop it.
Yeah.
Without a belief in a higher power and moral lawgiver, how do you know what is right and wrong?
This is actually a good question, in so much that it's a way a lot of people think. It's not the way Stephen thinks, and it's just as well. There is this idea that obviously that you need a higher power, that you need a lawgiver, and this is going back to things like commandments and how do you know to be good. God's written it into your heart, you know, that murder is wrong. The argument is, you know, all humans know that murder is wrong. How do they know this? And I just point to the fact that just because we don't know, you know, I mean, there's evolutionary explanations. It's a very old philosophical question, but just because we don't know the answer to it, we can't just assert blindly that God wrote it in our hearts and things like that. In terms of how can I be moral? I can be moral the same reason everyone else can be moral, because we have empathy. And it's quite easy, if you think, wouldn't want that done to me, that is where we know that something is wrong or something is good. And it's good just because we know it is. That's it.
So religion isn't necessarily the force for good then, John?
Well, that's what my argument is.
My argument is that it can be and is. So,
But you can be a good person. It doesn't matter what you believe in.
Yeah, I don't think it's my argument is I don't think it's mutually exclusive. I don't think you have to be religious to be good. I don't think you have to be atheist to be bad. Do you know what I mean? You can be a good atheist
and you can be a bad
Christian.
Exactly.
And I think that, you know, religion does inspire people to goodness, which maybe they wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah. And just to pick up and agree with you in a big way. Like, you can have a bad atheist, like Pol Pot,
Mao Zedong, for example.
Yeah. And then, you know, but I don't think that he was bad because he was an atheist, just like I wouldn't say that Hitler was bad because he was a Catholic.
Because he made the decisions. Yeah.
So, and that's why I didn't want to go to the body count, because I think it's actually against, it's bad for debate, because it just turns into the body count. But ultimately, I just think that there are just certain aspects of religion which short-circuit the critical thinking. And I think that's why you have people that are probably very selfless people will say some of the most bigoted things you'll hear, you know, like homosexuality is abomination, you know. I mean, that can only come from, you know, from scripture at the end of the day, because, and I think that is the only argument I've got against it, is that why shortcut? Why not think about it for yourself? And I'm all for people thinking about it themselves first, rather than just going every time with what they've been told.
Yes, I agree totally. Right, I think we are about done. Thank you very much on behalf of the speakers and the Think Rant podcast. I'd like to thank everybody who listened to the argument. I'd just like to say that we welcome any feedback on the podcast blog at stabler.tv, or you can visit our Facebook or Twitter pages. If you like the podcast or debates, then please leave us some feedback on iTunes to help us reach more people. Unwaith eto, diolch yn fawr a noswaith dda. Once again, thank you and good evening.
And just to let you know, you can also download the speeches from the blog. We'll be linking to them from Facebook, so you can have a look yourselves. Well, thanks for listening, guys. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.